Good morning. Welcome to Focus, Hour 2. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour of the program, we'll be taking your questions on women's health. Every other month is a topic that we feature with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area, and for a very long time, she's been a regular on our show so that we could bring you this topic. She comes prepared to talk about some things that are new in her field or newer, she would like you to know about. But also we'd like you to know that we're open to questions. Now, with the qualification that diagnosis over the phone isn't something we can do, we do programs like this to add to your health knowledge. And if you have some questions, this will be a place that you can start, ask questions, and Dr. Suzanne will do her best to answer them. And all you have to do is call us, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Or if you would like, you can send your question to us by email, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here you want to call, you want to email, send us your questions. We'll be happy to have them. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, there's a whole bunch of things you came prepared to talk about. I don't know if there's any.
I did. I made a top 10 list for you.
All right. Top 10 things. You want to start with
sure.
item number one?
Start with item number one. So these 10 things are what I think somewhat game changers in the way we practice gynecology. And I just think that we've gone over many of them, but maybe not in a whole group in a way to discuss it. So I made my top 10 list here. And the first one is that we are in our war, quote unquote, against cervical cancer. And I know people are making fun of when you say a war against anything that isn't a war, but in our attempts to eliminate cervical cancer, we are now focusing on preventing the cause of cervical cancer, which is HPV vaccination, and actually focusing on doing pap smears less on women that have had pap smears and trying to spend our collective healthcare dollar, meaning the country's collective healthcare dollar, on identifying people who have either not gotten screened at all with pap smears or have gotten so infrequently screened that literally 10, 20, 30 years have gone by. And if we target that group, those are individuals who are more at risk for cervical cancer. And to do better at cervical cancer prevention, we need to do those two things, because HPV vaccination can eliminate 80% of all cases of cervical cancer straight off the bat. And we're not doing a very good job in HPV vaccination in the U.S. right now. Only about 11% of our eligible patients since the HPV vaccine has been on the market have been vaccinated. So that's a pretty low number. Also, our number two, I'm just going to go straight into it, are coming up with alternatives to hysterectomy. We probably have over 500,000 hysterectomies performed each year in the United States for heavy bleeding. And now we have many alternatives that aren't just birth control pills, but we have actually expanded the types of contraceptive pills that we have. But we also now have non-hormonal methods, such as using the transaminic acid, or long-term contraceptive methods, such as the medicated IUD that actually decreases menstrual bleeding, as well as the surgeries that we've talked about now and then, the endometrial ablation for women who've completed their childbearing. So we have many, many alternatives to hysterectomy now that we didn't have a couple of decades ago. My number three is another thing that has been in the media a lot lately, which is that you should focus on the disease, not the biomarker. So one of the big news stories was that HDL, the good cholesterol, may not be so good. And that it may, in fact, just be a sign of other things happening. And an excellent example of this is also that we no longer treat patients based on just the bone density test, your score on a bone density test, but we now take that as one piece of information and try to predict your actual fracture risk. So we want to treat patients based on their risk of disease, not the biomarker. The biomarkers are important, and they single out groups to more carefully study and different ways to approach problems. But the biomarkers themselves are not the disease. I think number four has also, it's been a little bit of a behind-the-scenes topic, honestly. I don't know that we've ever talked about it, but the prevention of deep vein blood clots, particularly before and after childbirth, whether it be a vaginal birth or C-section, before and after major gynecologic surgery. We're doing a lot of things behind the scenes in terms of preventing those deep vein clots that cause a significant amount of both disease or morbidity as well as actual mortality in the United States. And the American College of Cardiology has just come out with an entire major manifesto regarding what we should do on an ongoing basis, even for more clinic-type patients, not just surgical-type patients, to prevent deep vein blood clots. So that's a big kind of game changer for the way we treat our patients. And my number five was changing systemic hormone therapy to local hormone therapy. So I think when I first started doing this radio show, I used to say things like 98% of all women were eligible for hormone replacement therapy. And they were back then. And many of those women still are excellent candidates for at least short-term, lower-dose hormone therapy. But we also now realize that to stay with sexually active, with healthy vaginal area, with healthy bladder as you age, actually not treating systemically, but just treating locally. And I think I would go as far to say that 98% of sexually active menopausal patients will probably benefit from some sort of local hormonal therapy. So we've changed how we do that significantly. Mm. Should we take our call or should we go on to our list?
I tell you what, why don't we
do our list real fast?
Let's pause. Okay. You got halfway through the list.
I got halfway.
Because we have a caller. Rather than make the caller wait.
Good idea.
We'll get to the caller. Dr. Suzanne Troopin is our guest. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist, has practiced here in our area for many years, has been a regular feature of the show so that we could have predictable opportunities for you to ask questions about women's health. It can be something that she's touched on already, but it doesn't have to be. Could be anything that falls within her area of practice. You can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Champaign as our first, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to hear you, David. Good to hear Dr. Troopin. I don't know which number it was, three, four, whatever. I was intrigued and really delighted to hear that they're beginning to focus on the entire patient, that the HDL level isn't necessarily any given specific good sign. It may just indicate that somebody walks or exercises or eats a little more healthily. I do not find that most physicians talk with one another. If, for example, you could actually get physicians who had brief conversations, say an orthopedic surgeon with a rheumatologist, which would be very handy for me, if they actually spoke together and had a sense of how their practice interfaces with one another and with the patient. And I can't really honestly understand why dentists and the health of the mouth isn't part of the whole view of a patient, since I'm almost sure that the mouth is a part of the head, which is luckily connected to the body. What changes are physicians and medical schools making so that they grasp the person as a whole patient, and so the patient knows occasionally a physician picks up a telephone and talks to another? At one point, I asked the people in physical therapy, well, how often does the orthopedic surgeon come and visit with you? The reply was, virtually never. So I want to know, from the viewpoint of a physician who's highly respected, what kind of changes are happening that might allow a patient to think the future is looking brighter in terms of being viewed as an entire physical and maybe even mental entity. And it's good to hear Dr. Troopin again. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you.
You're making excellent points, and there are a number of ways that we've tackled that issue. So there are, for instance, on a sort of baby level that wouldn't really address the whole problem, but on a localized level, there are physicians that are, say, an orthopedic surgeon that might employ the physical therapist, and in that way, having these networks of exactly the different specialties that work together. That's where spine institutes or pain institutes or breast cancer institutes, that's how they approach the integration idea. Medicare has approached a concept of your medical home, and that is sort of taking the primary care strategy, and I'll get back to that in a second, but getting the primary care strategy to approach you as this is where your medical home is. You're going to start with all your care, and then all your specialists are going to network in and out of your medical home. So that in the past, we talked about this kind of negative concept of gatekeeper, which the idea was that exactly what you're talking about, to somehow get these specialists talking to each other. And the idea was that the primary care person would then say to you, yes, you do need now a consult with your orthopedic surgeon, maybe instead of the physical therapy. But it ended up being tied so heavily to the way reimbursement flowed and to whether an individual patient could make that decision. If you decided you wanted to do the orthopedic consult first rather than the physical therapy first, then it led to more antagonistic approach. So it has to flow both ways, probably, to work very smoothly. Integrated electronic medical records, particularly in the big clinics, I think has helped a lot, because not only didn't the specialists, who maybe don't even have the time, be able to talk to each other, but you couldn't even access their records easily. But now with everything on electronic records, at least you get access to the copy of the film and the copy of the blood tests and that sort of thing. So that's a lot. And then ultimately you get access to the final note, and we're transmitting that very quickly. Also, there's been a lot of gaps in our medical care, because the doctor may say to you or your healthcare provider, go get such and such test. But until we see that test back on our desk, it maybe didn't always flow so smoothly to say, oh, but patient A, she's gotten that test. It just hasn't come back to our desk. But patient B never went for that test at all. And we need that information back on our desk as importantly. So there are so many different ways that the change of medical practice has progressed to get a more centralized system. But I think she's right. We have a long way to go. And I'm with her about the dentists. I never quite understood why they weren't part of medicine, but because we've integrated podiatry, which wasn't ever integrated exactly, but maybe dental care will be integrated. I have a feeling we can have a dentist call in and speak for themselves, but okay. I think it's probably more on their end than any other end.
Well, I appreciate the question. Other questions are welcome. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's here every other month. It's always a Monday, and talks about women's health. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, when you came in, you came with this list.
I came with my list, and I'm on number six.
So we're halfway through.
Okay. And number six has to do with a topic we talk about all the time, which are the non-contraceptive benefits of birth control pills. And we've called them oral contraceptives, and we've called them birth control pills. And I think to maybe take this concept a little bit farther, we should rename them, as well as take our concept farther, and I'm renaming them as cycle management pills rather than birth control or contraceptive pills, because many patients will be offered these therapy for medical purposes, having nothing. The side effect is obviously contraception, but that isn't always even the primary goal. And I think that having them named as only contraceptive pills when they do so much. Birth control pills, because I know that the other physicians out there haven't caught on to my renaming as of today, but these pills that should be called cycle management pills that are called birth control pills, they can significantly reduce, for instance, the numbers of ovarian cysts and improve fertility because they reduce the numbers of surgeries for ovarian cysts and ultimately also can eliminate about 80% of cases of ovarian cancer that we have, which is such a deadly cancer. So that if we focus, which I think the gynecologists have been, on the non-contraceptive benefits, that health has been enhanced significantly. So that's my number six. My number seven has been the IUD resurrection. IUDs were intrauterine devices for contraception, were used so frequently when I finished my residency, came into practice. They literally vanished from the U.S. market, but worldwide all this time have been the number one actual contraceptive method used worldwide. And now that we have a medicated IUD that is also approved for controlling heavy bleeding, as well as a improved copper IUD, the Paragard, IUDs have made a big comeback. And I think that that has also been a dramatic change in the past 10, 20 years. I think my number eight is that, not completely, but breast cancer with our enhanced mammographic technologies and our enhanced mammogramic programs and education, and again, getting the word out to have these tests, we have taken what used to be a significantly fatal case in a high percentage of patients to something that if your breast cancer is found early on mammogram only, virtually 98-99% of patients will outlive that diagnosis. So we've taken it at least from becoming a fatal disease to a radiologically detective disease. Not in every case, but we've made incredible strides in that. And so that's been a huge success and a changer as well. And then we have gone into changing of how we test patients and treat patients. And we really have had genetic testing become one of our game changers in terms of how we approach patients. So even patients approaching routine prenatal care, a significant percentage get tested for their gene carrier status for cystic fibrosis. And it just goes on from there. Now we even have certain medications that you never receive without getting a genetic test to see how your liver is going to handle that medication. And I think that the whole thing will snowball. We have a blood test that couples can take. It's about $350 that detects over 100 types of autosomal recessive genetic diseases, and couples either with infertility or miscarriages or literally just planning pregnancy can take this test and then find out what their plan should be in terms of reproduction or testing or special considerations. And then I was just at our American College of OBGYN Society meeting, and at that meeting, I found another test that's going to be similar to this one. But for instance, on amniocentesis, you could actually be tested for 4,300 genetic diseases, this reminds me of what the first caller said, that how are these doctors going to get together? And again, some of these technologies are moving so fast away from where we trained and what knowledge we can keep up with, that just keeping these doctors informed as to all these new tests and what do you do with the, if you got that report back with 4,300 answers on it, what do you do with that report, and which ones of those kinds of things would be important as we would go forward, or something you can ignore, and if you can ignore it, why would you get that tested? So I think that's what's going to really be. And then I think another thing is a lot of awareness of problems that people didn't like to talk to their doctors about. And one would be sexual dysfunction. One will be urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, So things that people just didn't feel comfortable with talking to their gynecologists about 20 years ago, now it's common discussion. And I think that's going to lead us to the paths of being able to come up with some treatments and diagnosis.
All right. Well, questions about any of that and other aspects of women's health, they are welcome. That's what we're doing here this morning. We do every other month with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area and has been a regular feature of the show for a long time. We have someone here ready to go and would be happy to take other calls, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here is a caller in Rantoul on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you, Dave.
Sure.
I was just curious, all these cancers that are out there, I'm kind of skeptical with this, and I'm just wondering if somebody ever came up with a cure for some of this stuff, what would happen to all the, say, drug manufacturers or the companies that make the, you know, machines that help with that. And because my dad.
The caller's still there? I think we lost the caller. We can pick up on the question, though, I guess. Maybe the question would be, well, how, and I'm not even sure that it's appropriate to use a word like cure.
Well,
when we're talking about cancer.
Why don't we talk about it in the context of other things,
okay.
For instance. So we used to spend a tremendous amount of healthcare dollars on the care of polio before the vaccination.
Okay.
Then we came up with the polio vaccination, and you didn't need the breathing machines and the iron lungs, which were very expensive and tremendous business for the iron lung machines. You didn't need those anymore, and those passed out of use. So there are many aspects of medicine like that. We used to have a lot of tuberculosis, and we had whole sanatoriums for tuberculosis patients that we don't have anymore because we have the modern management and diagnosis of and prevention of tuberculosis. So I think that what he's saying is true, and I think that the future of medicine is going to change. There's one model out there that says that, for instance, the ideal primary care scenario would be a doctor sitting ready at their desk with no patients to see. And the reason is because
everybody was so healthy.
Everybody's so healthy. So your diabetics, their blood sugar is perfect. They don't have to come to see you. Your hypertensives, their management, they're out, they're getting their exercise, they're measuring their blood pressure at home. They're not coming in to see you. And so that you could be rewarded based on the people you didn't need to see. Now, in some scenarios, that's a little bit... I heard this term this morning, I think, when I was listening to Radio Kabuki Theater or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a little dramatic, over-dramatized. Yeah. But... I think that there will be a lot of truth to that. On the same token that as we've moved forward, we've cured polio and we've cured tuberculosis and we've cured a lot of things. We've also invented the internet and the channel changer and our problems of obesity and all that surrounds obesity is going to almost overtake all the rest of everything in medicine. So I think we'll have that issue. But I think that as the medical industry and as the pharmaceutical companies go forward, there's plenty to do.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to your number one thing about the focus on prevention of HPV, the human papilloma virus. Just if we went out and we started testing people,
okay,
how widespread is HPV?
Are we testing males and females in the United States today?
Yes.
So there are two concepts in testing. There's the incidence and the prevalence. So what we want to know is, at any one time, how many people are infected with this virus? And probably the quick answer to that, that we've estimated is about 40 million. Is that the total burden in the United States? Probably not. They estimate that something like 80 to 90% of people will become, may not even want to use the word infected. We may want to use the word colonized and then resolve their infection. So it's a huge problem. But if we take the population where we want to vaccinate, the 9 to 12 year olds, virtually none of them are, there are some, unfortunately, some that pick it up in birthing, some that pick it up from touching. But the vast majority of the 9 to 12 year old girls and boys are negative. And if we vaccinate them against the prevalent HPV types, those individuals will now move forward through their entire adulthood and not get infected. If we do catch-up vaccinations, meaning somewhere between age 12 and 26, when the vaccines are approved for that age group, we can prevent a significant amount of disease, but we start running into the problem that some of our patients have now already acquired the HPV infection, and this is not a therapeutic vaccine that we know of. It's a preventive vaccine. Mm-hmm. So if you've acquired one or more of the four types that are in the vaccine, you won't necessarily have that vaccine be as effective because you can now still be susceptible to disease from the types you've already acquired prior to when you got vaccinated. And of the something like only, I may be getting this statistic slightly off, but one of the reasons only 11% of patients that were eligible have been vaccinated is about 43% of individuals who undertake vaccination don't complete the series.
So they start, but they don't.
They get one, they get two. They either lose their insurance or lose their motivation or move or something else happens and they don't get the third shot.
So I think also people should probably understand here that what we're talking about with this virus is getting at the strains of human papilloma that are implicated in cancer. There are lots of them. So even if everybody gets vaccinated, we're not going to wipe human papilloma virus off the face of the earth. We're just trying to get at the ones that
are most problematic. So there are probably 100 types, and depending on how you view a type, there are some researchers that will say there's closer to 200 types. Mm-hmm. And as I said, there are four types right now in the current vaccine. There are vaccine trials right now that have 9 different types. We think that some of the types are so similar that if you could develop immunity to one, that you would develop immunity to the other similar type to some extent. So we think there are 14 of the major causes of at least genital and head and neck cancers. And so the 9-valent vaccine is going to go a long way to getting much of HPV eliminated, but
and
I'm
also thinking about how long, if we really could get people vaccinated, how long it would take to make a big dent. Would it take one generation, 2 generations?
That is such a good question. I couldn't have planted that question even better. They've already seen, so in Australia, when we approved the HPV vaccine, we only approved it in females because of the way things are in the U.S., but Australia, and now it's approved in boys as well. And the package insert actually does talk about the age 26 to 45 females as well, which we could get back to if somebody's interested. But in Australia, they started treating the girls and the boys, and within a couple of years, they already were seeing lower rates of high-grade cervical dysplasia, carcinomas in situs, and cancers.
So almost right away,
boom,
you're seeing an effect.
Right away. Mm-hmm. If we could, but they have a huge population percentage that's vaccinated. So it was girls, it was boys, and it was a huge uptake. We're nowhere close here. And we don't actually envision, we envision that it's going to improve and there's campaigns to get it to improve, but it's going to be a long time till we see what they've seen.
We'll talk some more, including taking a call here as we talk some more with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Sacha Baron Cohen talks about his new comedy, The Dictator, in which he plays the corrupt, tyrannical ruler of a fictional oil-rich nation in northern Africa.
I am for free press, fair elections, and equal rights for women. I can't say that.
Sacha Baron Cohen on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here from 10 to noon, Monday through Friday, with different topics every day and every week. And tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll review current events in Burma. Big changes going on in that country. We'll talk with Christina Fink, a professor of international affairs at George Washington University. In the 10 o'clock hour, then in hour two, our guest is Howard Rheingold. He's an author quite well known for writing about the internet and virtual communities and information technology. He's been doing that for a long time. He has a new book out, which takes a look at what things we can do to make the best and the most of social media without being overloaded by it. His book is titled Net Smart: How to Thrive Online. You can check the schedule, find out what the rest of the week looks like, or listen to past programs by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. This morning in this hour of Focus, our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's here every other month, always a Monday. We talk about women's health. Questions are welcome. And we have someone ready to go here who's been waiting patiently. We'll get them in Gilman, line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Recently, it seems like there has been a more awareness of these superbugs. People who are going into the hospital and actually developing MRSA and other superbug hard to deal with diseases or whatever you want to call it that the standard antibiotics are having trouble dealing with. Is there much research going on to the fact of, is it something we're eating? Is there a correlation between, we'll say, the antibiotics that are being used in agriculture or those kind of things that are coordinating with these so-called superbugs that are happening?
So it's a great question and a little bit far from the straightforward field of gynecology, but I think there has been a lot of attention as to where we're going in terms of going forward with antibiotic use, infections, antibiotic success, susceptibility of bacterial strains to antibiotics, and there has been quite a push in medicine in general in the past decade to take a step back and not treat viral infections with antibiotic therapies that were meant for bacterial infections and to let some kinds of diseases run their courses and to use the more straightforward antibiotics rather than our big gun antibiotics for treating uncomplicated infections, and then when to bring out the big gun antibiotics and what kinds of things to look forward to look for and when to test appropriately so that we can make the diagnosis of some of these more serious infections. So I think that's where from my field of gynecology we've gone with that. We years ago, for instance, when we performed a cesarean birth, we just tried to be, say, clean and sterile. But now we virtually always at least give a dose of antibiotics, but somewhere's in the middle. We used to give a day or a couple of days of antibiotics as a prevention, and now we realize that a single dose is adequate for prevention for most cases. So we've changed how we approach things in many aspects of medicine, and I think that will help. Now, in terms of new antibiotic therapies, we haven't done a very good job bringing in new antibiotic therapies to the basic market. And not only that, but scrutinizing some of our current therapies has led us to find that even some antibiotic therapies that we consider very routine and straightforward to use could even cause heart arrhythmias, and there's a lot of new emerging studies. So it's a great question for, say, an infectious disease specialist to really give you the full scoop, but it's something that's definitely on the radar of many physicians.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller. Others are welcome to call. We have about 10, 15 minutes left in this part of Focus with Dr. Suzanne Trupin. It's our monthly program on women's health, and if you have questions, you can give us a call. Coming back to, again, to HPV, the issue there, and we have talked, and on some other shows, we have talked recently about changes in the recommendations for various kinds of tests and screening procedures. We've talked about changes when it comes to pap smear, and we probably also have talked changes when it comes to breast cancer. And people are familiar that has been some debate now going on about screening for prostate cancer. And there are a number of things now where it's kind of in flux. So having said all that, first of all, testing for human papillomavirus, do you think that people should be tested?
Well, I do think that the right group of patients would significantly benefit from human papillomavirus testing. We know that a single pap smear could miss as much as 50% of very high-grade disease. And missing high-grade disease can be serious, although in the past, when we used to do many serial pap smears, you didn't usually miss it for very long, because by the time you get your second and third and fifth pap smear, most of those cases are going to show up. You're not going to miss it every time. But by adding in the human papillomavirus as a test for the appropriate group of patients, which is likely to be over the age of 30, but we may pull that down to be over the age of 25, but at least over the age of 30, we find that doing both those tests together increase our pickup rate of serious disease very significantly. We get down to a miss rate of very, very, very low. So people do need that test.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you about one other thing, just because it's been in the news lately, and you're the first doctor that I've had the opportunity to talk with about it. And I know it's one of the things that you did actually have on your list. There is now a recommendation that people should be tested for hepatitis C?
Yes. So it kind of speaks to the entire realm of STD testing. So we used to try to get all patients routinely screened for whole batteries of STD tests. And for instance, with gonorrhea and chlamydia, we got down to saying that the population under 25 is really the group that we should screen. For prenatal patients, we have been screening for syphilis, for HIV. We've been screening for hepatitis B for a long time. And now hepatitis C testing has crept onto the radar. And the stories that broke over the weekend were talking about baby boomer age groups that may, in fact, have acquired this infection and literally never been tested for it. And one of the signs and symptoms might be, for instance, fatigue, which is a common complaint for many reasons, but at least getting that initial screening test, it's an easy, relatively affordable test. And one of the other reasons that we're starting to encourage patients to get tested is that there's an effective treatment. So that, say, a couple of decades ago, we would find variation of certain types of hepatitis, but we wouldn't have a treatment for it. Mm-hmm. So we weren't that anxious to screen for it because we didn't have an effective way to get rid of that viral infection. But now we do. And if you get rid of the infection, not only do you feel better, but you're less likely, or if it's completely eliminated, virtually won't pass it on to a sexual partner. And furthermore, down the line, you are less at risk for ever developing liver cancer.
Okay. We have another caller here, someone in Savoy, and that's our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to talk a little bit about the HPV virus. I know that they are touting this vaccine. I want you to know that there's a lot more to it than what the medical community normally tells you. All vaccine reaction. Well, first of all, let me tell you this. In the vaccine trials, they said that the number of people that were injured by the vaccine wasn't much different than the placebo group. However, in the placebo group, which are the people who are supposed to receive the innocuous saline solution, whatever it is that they use that is supposed to...
Actually, the placebo group got the vaccine base, but it didn't have the HPV. It didn't have the HPV, but it was a vaccine. It had the same base that the vaccines themselves are made out of.
Yes.
It wasn't saline.
That's what I'm saying is the placebo is supposed to be a nothing thing. There were the same ingredients in it lacking the HPV virus. And one of the ingredients
Let me interrupt for 1 second because what the placebo group is determined by a number of factors, the researchers themselves, the FDA oversight groups, the institutional review boards that review the ethics of the trial. And so it's not just that the placebo group is supposed to be, quote unquote, nothing. That a little bit of a misconception in terms of how research trials are performed.
When you use the same ingredients in a placebo as you use in the vaccine, you are then able to say that in the placebo group there were no more injuries from the vaccine group than there were in the placebo group. That is very, very misleading.
We don't have a whole lot of time. Maybe if you can come to the central point that you'd like to make, and then the doctor can address that, because we really only have about 5 minutes.
I think that if you went on VAERS to read the vaccine adverse events reports, you would see all the vaccine injuries and the case studies that read like a catalog of horrors for young girls that have taken it. The reason that they are only getting 1 and 2 vaccines is because they can't deal with the side effects of the vaccines. And I think people need to do a lot more research into VAERS, the Adverse Events Reporting System, before they have their kids vaccinated, and the way that it was developed.
Okay, fair point. Can you respond to that?
So I think that they do a great job, and I should say that I was an investigator in that trial, which I have said before. So, but I think that Gardasil.com has a great website, and I think that the safety of this vaccine is not 100%, but extraordinary, and that patients should know that if they've gotten, say, for instance, vaccinated against hepatitis B, it's the same basic component in that vaccine, which is a vaccine component that we have a tremendous track record with. But if you want to understand the actual safety studies and the ongoing safety surveillance and the actual data on what any side effects were, for instance, fainting is a known side effect from getting a vaccination that does occur, that going to either the Merck Services website and going into the patient portals from that, or going to Gardasil.com, and the information on those sites is very comprehensive and I think actually would reassure moms significantly of the safety of this vaccine.
Is there reason to think that if people are not completing the series as recommended, it's because there has been some sort of bad reaction to the first shot?
I would think that there there are some patients that would fall in that category. In the U.S., there's a significant barrier in terms of money because the vaccine is relatively expensive, and from state to state, it significantly varies in terms of coverage. And we know that that is a barrier. I think that education in terms of what this vaccine can do in terms of preventing head and neck cancers, cervical cancer, vaginal cancer, vulvar cancer, anal cancer, rectal cancers. I think when the population really understands, as well as the prevention of a significant percent, about 60 to 75% of all genital wart cases. So when you get these vaccines, the risk-benefit ratio is quite impressive, and that the benefits are there. And I think that as we become more educated, that patients will realize that.
So what, outside of the United States, what country has had the longest track record of this? Is it Australia?
Norway. Norway has, when you're born in Norway, you get a number. And they track your health forever. And they've just published their 7-year safety data out of Norway. And you can get access to that information from the Gardasil sites. And they have a very high uptake in vaccine. And they have a lot of it, a lot of data. So in terms of the safety, the long-term studies, Norway has the best information.
We're coming down to the point. We have just have a couple minutes left. I want to thank the caller and just ask sort of a more general question that was sort of raised in my mind by an earlier caller in a conversation that we had with them. We've done a pretty good job of, that is, the medical science has done a pretty good job of responding to infectious disease. And not perfect, but a pretty good job. And of course, we can expect there will be emergent new infectious diseases. But, we've done a pretty good job with what we have so far. So we're starting to see much more disease that is related to the way people live their lives. So we've got diabetes. We've got heart disease. Then we have diseases that may have environmental components. Some cancers may. We have diseases like Alzheimer's, which may be one of those diseases that it's a disease of living long. We're starting to see people who are also living longer and developing diseases in greater numbers where we might not have in the past if we didn't have so many people living to an older age. So I guess I'm having said all that, I wonder how you think just with your specific kind of practice, say with obstetrics and gynecology, how do you think that's going to change what it is that you do?
Well, a lot has changed. For instance, we have more older moms having their first babies, and that is more of a challenge. We have more moms who have had prior treatments that they never would have survived that are entering pregnancy. So cancers in childhood, for instance, or very severe cases of diabetes or severe cases of heart disease, for instance, where people would not make it out of childhood in the past. Now, not only do they make it out of childhood, they make it into child rearing. And so approaching how we take care of those whole groups of patients has really changed things. And you're right. As we age, we're going to literally have the problems of aging. So say, where we might have had increased rates of, say, skin cancers and people that had too much sun exposure, you get old enough, even small sun exposure sitting next to a sunny window indoors is still sun exposure. You live old enough, we're going to see more skin cancers just strictly from aging. So that the focus has to be on what kinds of things should you look for in that population as they get a decade or two decades or three decades older than the patients that you were seeing previously. And you're very right. That will change the focus of the basic visit. So the basic visit won't necessarily be, let's get you on vitamins, you're planning to have a baby. The basic visits might be more focused on, okay, how are we going to make that diagnosis of Alzheimer's, even with whichever healthcare provider you interact with.
Yeah. And do you think that, you talked also about how there are certain things that people now are willing to talk about with their doctors than the past that they didn't because it was embarrassing. You know? So people are having issues with their sex lives. In the past, they didn't want to talk about that with their doctors, but I'm sure now that more and more people are certainly willing to talk about that.
Well, not only that, but it wasn't necessarily considered a problem you needed to fix, or it wasn't considered necessarily something that you could fix. Mm-hmm. And so we're moving past those kinds of concepts. And I think absolutely we need more research. We need better therapies. I'm often involved in research trials that I'm encouraging people to participate in that are better therapies for individual problems like incontinence or sexual dysfunction. And we do need better therapies still. But just by opening up that conversation, many patients can be effectively diagnosed and treated.
Yeah. Well, you've been doing this with us for a very long time now. And I wonder whether you think that, not in terms of something like this, but in terms of the doctor-patient relationship, do you think that more and more doctors are thinking about how part of what they're supposed to be doing with their patients is education?
Absolutely. And prevention. And really, it's new that we've thought about preventing disease so that, for instance, even you mentioned diabetes, but diagnosing the quote-unquote pre-diabetic. You never heard the term pre-diabetic. When I was in medical school, they were either diabetic or they weren't diabetic. And now as we move towards this pre-diagnosis, in many cases, I think that's where we have to focus our education. And absolutely figuring out which group you have to really educate to think about breast disease, which group you really have to think about educating in terms of diet and nutrition, which group you have to think about in terms of educating on STDs and whether or not you should screen for hepatitis C or those things. You want to focus your education because we don't have enough hours in the day or literally minutes during your doctor's appointment to focus in all those directions at once. Mm-hmm. So we need to target our different groups.
All right. Well, there we'll leave it with our thanks to Dr. Suzanne Troopen for so many years of service.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist here in our area. She's here every other month to talk about women's health.